It's interesting, as we're talking about art and innovation, how our society essentially sees art and the area of the humanities and explorations and innovations as kind of a sideline to the mainstream of life. The mainstream of life being business, getting on with business, getting on with the real things. What about that?
Well, I think one of the feelings today is that we lack roots. That wonderful poem of Yeats, you know, The Second Coming, where he says, turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. I think we feel that in ourselves. We feel it in the society. Where is the revelation? Well, revelations in the past, all the great scriptures, have come from poets and artists. I mean, these are the ones who hear. These are the ones whom we call seers. And it's the function, really, of the poet and the artist to do exactly what Joyce and Picasso have done. Push on into spiritual realms that are waiting to be found, because our life situation is so radically changing all the time. When you think of earlier centuries, from, I'd say, around 2000 B.C., when the agricultural societies became firmly established, to the middle of the 18th century, we had basically an agrarian world, you know, with the same social orders and the same essential technical problems. And then suddenly everything begins changing. And when you think what's happened since that time, man has been completely displaced from the old ways, and the old systems don't talk to us, really. We try to understand, but we don't feel it. You know, a revelation is not to be explained to you. It's to be immediately experienced with an aha, oh, that's it. And that's the poet's job. That's the artist's job. So I think they're the burning point. The business world is, for the most part, dealing with solutions that have already been achieved, you know, working them out. But even there, we see them in trouble now. They don't know how to handle these new situations. So there's revelation to be rendered on every level of our life, economic, political, social, emotional. It's a new world we've built for ourselves, and we have to learn to know it.
So the nature of our society is almost inhibiting to creativity, and yet we hear a lot about being creative, and wherever you walk, you hear about, well, I'd like to be creative, I'd like to be more creative. And in a sense, the way we approach our life and the way living in a modern society with all of its technology and the tremendous emphasis there is on rational, linear, logical thought processes, all of which have brought us great blessings as well, at the same time, we've gotten out of touch with that deeper side of ourselves, and perhaps the questions we ask and the problems that we present to ourselves as being so insoluble are really questions that go to a deeper root that lies in mythology, in the mythology of the world.
Well, the value of mythology in the old traditions, one of the values was that every activity in life had been mythologized. You saw something of its relevance to the great mysteries and your own participation in the great mysteries in the performance, in agriculture, in hunting, in military life, and so forth. All of these were turned into spiritual disciplines. Actually, they were. There were rituals associated with them, which let you know what spiritual powers were being challenged and evoked and brought into play through this action. Well, now, as I said before, our society has changed so fast that we have not had a chance to find what we're doing. And consequently, it's up to every single individual in his own life to analyze his psyche in relation to his life task. And if he finds it isn't working, well, then getting an income from that task isn't worth it. You've got to risk in order to find life. And people go into a work just thinking, well, this will make money for me, not thinking, gosh, this is what has inspired me to life action. They have to face it in the end and find some fighting way to turn that work into a creative experience.
Joseph, have you ever done anything in your life primarily for money?
No. absolutely not. Well, I would have, I think, but I came back from my student years in Europe in 1929, just about 2 weeks before the crash, and I didn't have a real job for 5 years. And I found then, I don't know whether it would work now, but I found then that a young man, unmarried, didn't need money. I could pretty well take care of myself for almost nothing. And then I took a little vow that I'd never work for money, because I've enjoyed myself just enormously, reading what I wanted to read and so forth. I dropped my work on the PhD because it would have required me to do things that I had already outgrown. In Europe, the world had opened up, as I said earlier, Joyce, among other things, but more than that, Sanskrit and the Orient and the relationship of all of this to psychology and all, and I couldn't just go back to finish up that PhD thesis, and I wouldn't do it. Besides, I didn't have the money to do it. And just that freewheeling, maverick life gave me a great sense of the deep joy in doing something that meant something for me. And then I found when I finally, after 5 years, was invited to teach at St. Lawrence College, that they were very much excited by what I had found I wanted to do. And I would not have taken the job if they would not have let me do that, just as I wouldn't take the PhD. And, well, I had luck. I had luck. I don't know how it would have been if I had been married at that time already with a child, let's say. That's something else. I can't speak to that point. But it wasn't by accident that I wasn't married and didn't have a child, because it was my notion that before anything like that, I should be prepared to take care of the situation.
Well, isn't there a myth that says you create your own luck?
That's not only a myth. There's a wonderful paper by Schopenhauer called An Apparent Intention of the Fate of the Individual. And he points out that when you are at a certain age, well, kind of age I'm at now, and look back over your life, it seems to be almost as orderly as a composed novel. And just as in Dickens' novels, little accidental meetings and so forth turn out to be main features in the plot, so in your life, funny little accidents and what seem to have been mistakes at the time turn out to have been directive crises in the life. And then he asks, who wrote this novel? You see, and you can ask yourself, it's as though it were planned, and there is something in us that's doing this. People speak of people accident-prone. It's something in themselves. They could even be in the car with you and you doing the driving, and it's not good to have them there, you know? So there's a mystery here. And Schopenhauer finally asked the question, can anything happen to you for which you're not ready? You don't know whether it can. I look back now on certain things that seemed to me at the time to have been real disasters, but the results of it having been a disaster instead of a success turned out to be the structuring of a really great aspect of my life and career. So what can you say?
Joseph, in our society, fairy tales are for children. What about the fairy tale for the adult? The fairy tale for the whole person?
Well, that's a good question. Most of the fairy tales are for children. Those that we like best usually represent a stopping at a threshold. The child doesn't want to grow up, you know? One of the problems in a neurosis is that the person hasn't grown up, hasn't moved from a position or attitude of dependency and expecting an authority into that of assuming his own authority and responsibility. And so, insofar as many adults haven't made that step, those children's stories are for them. But I think the later fairy tales for the adult individual are those of our religious traditions. The teachings of the Buddha, the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Zoroaster, I think these can be read as fairy tales. And what a fairy tale is, really, is a story that is not regarded as being true in the sense of being a historical truth. It's not a fact truth, but it's true in the way of an inward truth as a reference to one's own inward life. And if one reads the scriptures that way, not as references to history, but as references to one's own spiritual interior and its potentialities, then they are, as it were, fairy tales for adults. That's what I would say.